A number of years ago, in the south of Ireland, there was a presidential election. The outstanding candidate at that particular time was a man called Brian Lenihan. Some of you might be familiar with this and understand something of it. He was the favourite by a long chalk to become the next president of Ireland. In the opinion polls at that particular time, he was a straight ahead. There was nobody even close to him. I think the lowest opinion poll was around 70% he had of the vote. And he just looked like an absolute certainty to get in. Part of the deal that he had to swear an oath that he would serve the people of Ireland with integrity and with honesty. And he was willing to do that. That was no problem to him. He was willing to do that. He came out of a political family as it was a sort of a dynasty there. His father had been involved in politics, and his sister was a member of the government in Ireland as well. And after him, his son became a member of the Irish government as well. So he was someone who had grown up probably with a dream to be the president of Ireland. That may have been a dream that he had from he was a boyhood. But as he went around the campaign trail, someone asked him, just a simple question, they asked him if he had been involved some years earlier in having the government of the day in Ireland dissolved. Had he gone to the presidential residence and had the government of that particular day dissolved? Now, I don't know, by the way, the political implication of that. I don't really know what it is, but it was a big question anyway. And he said, no, he hadn't done that. He said he wouldn't do it. He said he would never do anything like that. But the question persisted. It kept coming up and coming up, and so did the denials. He said he didn't do it. He wasn't guilty of anything like that. And then maybe 3 days before the election, before the vote actually went out, somebody produced a videotape of a very young-looking Brian Lenihan in a students' union meeting, boasting that he was the one responsible for having the government of that particular day dissolved. That he had done it. He was caught red-handed, even though the videotape was there, it was on television, on the news at 6 o'clock, for the whole nation to see. It ran, and like these things do, they run and run and run. 6 o'clock news, 9 o'clock news, the next day again. Now, just kept playing it. And of course, the inevitable happened when the election came. He lost. He was defeated. It cost him the election. And let me tell you, it probably cost him his life as well. Because a short time afterwards, he died. It may have been the severe pressure of it all and whatever it was, but he died, and history tells us that Mary Robinson became the President of Ireland. And the point I'm trying to make in it all is that we live in a time when the promises that we make don't mean very much. People make promises when they get married. They make promises in other circumstances too, and they don't keep them. Doesn't seem all that important. Well, you know, it doesn't matter. That's how people think. It's easy to come and easy to go, and it doesn't really matter. And in 2 Samuel here, in chapter 9 and verse 1, it begins with David remembering that he had made a promise. And could I say that it was even more than a promise? It was a binding agreement. That's what it was. It was a covenant promise. A promise within a covenant. He had promised something. Let me read to you what it was. It's in 1 Samuel there, and chapter 20 and verse 15. I'll just read it to you. Or verse 14. But show me unfeeling kindness like that of the Lord as long as I live, so that I may not be killed. And do not ever cut off your kindness from my family, not even when the Lord has cut off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth. And so Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, may the Lord call David's enemies to account. And Jonathan made David affirm his oath out of love for him, because he loved him as he loved himself. The promise, a binding agreement, had been made that was going to hold him. And what happens here is that Jonathan is dead now. He's dead. But God brings these things to David's memory. Nobody else knew. There was nobody else knew about it. It had happened in a field between these two men. They made an agreement with each other. Nobody knew, only him and God. It wasn't as if other people were looking at him or trying to hold him to account in some way. It wasn't like that. And so we see the question in chapter 9 and verse 1, is anyone of Saul's household still living to whom I can show kindness? Or to whom I can show the promise, or keep the promise that I have made? Amazing that he should remember that. What makes the statement so remarkable is that anyone left in Saul's household would have been naturally seen as David's enemy. That's how it would have been seen. The whole idea was, the general practice was, you get into power. Kill anybody who might be a pretender to the throne. That's what you do. You don't. The Old Testament is full of it. We saw it during Saul's reign. Boy hunted David like a dog. Chased him everywhere for years. Saul was pretender to the throne, and he said, if I don't kill him, he's going to become king. And he hunted him and he hounded him. See it throughout the Old Testament where kings come on the throne and they kill anybody who might be a pretender. We saw it in the New Testament. Remember when Jesus was born? Herod tried to kill him. Saw him as a pretender to the throne. Tried to kill him, tried to wipe him out. And we see it today with dictators all over the world. That's what they do. That's what happens. And so what happens here is in verse 3, he sends for Ziba and he asks the same question in verse 3 there. The king asks, is there no one still left of the house of Saul to whom I can show God's kindness? The covenant love of God. Anybody left out there that I can show this kindness to? And Ziba in turn tells the king, he tells him that there's a son of Jonathan, a boy crippled in both feet. And if you read, let me read that to you as well, in chapter 4 and verse 4, 2 Samuel there, and this is what it says. Jonathan, son of Saul, had a son who was lame in both feet. He was 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel. His nurse picked him up and fled, and as she hurried to leave, he fell and became crippled. His name was Mephibosheth. So you see the picture. Here he is, he's a wee boy left and he's crippled. And the king asked the question in verse 4, where is he? And he's told by this man, Ziba, that he's down in the house of Machir in Lodabar. That's where he is. And so what we see is we see the story taking on a spiritual dimension. Machir means perishing. Lodabar means wilderness. And so the picture is, here is someone who is suffering from the fall. Perishing in the wilderness. Someone who has been crippled by the fall. Perishing in the wilderness. See, that's how we all are. Every one of us are like that this evening. Every one of us have been damaged by the fall. It doesn't matter who you are or where you're coming from. When Adam sinned in the Garden of Eden, he brought sin and destruction upon every one of us. That's how we are. You just look around the world tonight, you can see that. You can see it in children. Yeah, I know that you had Owen here a couple of weeks ago or a month or so ago. My son. I always remember Owen when he was a wee boy. He could hardly walk, you know that, and he could hardly talk. sitting in the chair one night, we're having our dinner in the house there, and the phone rang, and Pat got up to answer the phone, and he was sitting there, and he reached over, and he got a plate, and he pulled it onto the floor, and boy, hit the tiles of slap there, and it went into about a million pieces, and there it was lying there. I just ate away. There was nothing I could do about it anyway. And Pat came in from the phone, and she said, "Who broke the plate?" I tell you, you could hardly talk. Nobody said, "Daddy did it." And that's the honest truth now. He could hardly talk. But he knew enough. He knew enough to shift the blame. Boy, it wasn't me. And that's what he was doing, shifting the blame. And see, we're all like that. We didn't have to teach him to do that. That's how we are. We're like that by nature. That's how we are. When Adam fell in the Garden of Eden, we all fell. We all went down, all crippled, if you like, by the fall. And every human being in the world, every single one, born in that fallen state. And nothing we can do about it. You know that? I don't want to be born like that. Don't want my grandchildren to be born like that. Don't want to be like that. That's how I am. That's how you are. Can't do anything about it. That's how we are. All perishing, if you like, in this spiritual wilderness. The sin that we're born with, it just simply drags us down. Awful position. Picture of misery and of hopelessness. All of us drifting to death and drifting to hell. Need to remember that. You've got grandchildren. You've got children tonight. We nippers. Look, don't you forget this. That they're not saved. They're going to hell. That's how they are. Can't dress that up in some other language and make it better than it really is. See, this is reality. When we do children's clubs, there's wee children there playing and they're having a bit of fun, maybe fall out with each other. But you need to reach them for Jesus. Because left in that condition, that's where they're going to go. An awful picture, but it's real. And that's why the gospel is not very popular. That's why people don't like to listen to the gospel, and they don't like it. See, nobody wants to see themselves like this. See, I talked there about Owen, and as a wee boy, and you see, what happens is that we're all like that. We do things to get when we're young. Let me tell you, as we grow up, we become more crafty. We begin to find ways of disguising our sin and hiding our sin. We begin to make people, or try to make people believe that we're better than we really are. We don't really want people to know what we're really like. Don't want people to really know what our minds are like and what our hearts are like. And we become experts at being able to cover it. We can pretend all sorts of stuff. You can come to church here and just sit there and nobody knows. We can cover it up and we can pretend. That's how we are. But I tell you, it's an awful position to be in when you see that. And nobody likes to see themselves like this. You know, during this year, we had a woman come into our Bible study in Drogheda. She was a lady. She was married to Lord Earn or someone like that. But she was really somebody, and she came in, and she was tremendously well-spoken. She had been a television personality in Ireland for a number of years, though I didn't know her at that time or anything like that. And her big question was, why did Jesus have to die? Can't understand why. If he's so perfect and everything else, why did he have to die? You see, she didn't understand her sin. Didn't understand that it was her condition and my condition that caused Jesus' death on a cross. Didn't understand that. We had a lady come in from the Legion of Mary. And she saw one of the young girls in the meeting, teenager, and she said to this girl, "What are you doing here?" And the wee girl said to her, "You know, these meetings changed my life." She couldn't understand why. Someone would come to a meeting like this, to a Bible study. Didn't understand her sin. Didn't understand that it was her sin and that put Jesus on a cross. Didn't want to take it into her thinking. And here's Mephibosheth, living down in the wilderness, perishing in the wilderness, crippled. And let me tell you how he sees himself now. He believes himself to be the enemy of the king. That's what he believes. He says, I'm an enemy of the king. He believes that if he's found out, the king will kill him. He believes that if he's found out, he's going to die. He's under the sentence of death. He's living under condemnation. That's how he's living here. He didn't deliberately offend the king. He didn't deliberately set out to offend the king. He's like this by birth. Happens to be born into this family, and that's how he is. Living under condemnation. This is how he lives. He never knows the moment when his past will catch up with him, when the king will catch up with him, and he'll die. Never knows. You see, that's the picture of the world tonight. That's how people are. That's how we're wired when God made us. He wired us in this particular way. That you know that judgment is coming down the line. It's why death is so frightening for so many people. That they know that it's already in their heart. That judgment is coming. That's how they are. And living under this condemnation of death. And it's what spoils life for so many people. You take all the people that are in our world that seem to be the movers and shakers in our world. The footballers and the rock stars and the film stars and all these people that should have it all. And yet there is so much unhappiness and fear among them all. And this is the reason why. Because they know that no matter what they have and no matter what they do, they're never going to be able to shake off this sense that they're living under condemnation. Living under the sentence of death. And this is how he lives. This is how Mephibosheth lives. Position of everybody. Fear of death coming. Fear of judgment. You know that story in Mark chapter 10 there and verse 17. The story that what we call the rich young ruler. Comes running to Jesus. And the big question is, what must I do to inherit eternal life? Boy, here he was, and with all his decency and respectability, he had all those things. Good lad. In the eyes of the world, he was a good lad. But he knew that there was something missing in it all. What must I do to inherit eternal life? I don't want to die like this. I need something that will change the way I am. That's what he was saying here. Decent and respectable, but lost. And you see, here's another thing too about this wee boy Mephibosheth, or this man Mephibosheth down here. Mephibosheth knows he's got nothing to offer. You know, he can't turn around and say to the king, well, look, king, I'll tell you, what about you and me doing a deal here? He has got nothing now. Listen, he's got nothing that the king needs. He's got nothing to barter with. He can't say to the king, I'll give you this, you give me that. He can't do that. He's got nothing. He's a cripple living, perishing in the wilderness. Got nothing to deal with. You know, I tell you, see what I think of that can make me cry, you know that. It moves my heart when I think of that. What can I give God? What can I give? I have nothing to give. All I have is my sin. My filthy life. Nothing to barter with. Nothing that the king needs. Neither of you. And this is how Mephibosheth was. And you see, and as far as he's concerned here, he's got no grounds for mercy. He doesn't have any grounds for mercy as far as he's concerned. You see, and the thing is, as he sits in this dreadful state, he's no idea. He hasn't a notion in all the world that the king is searching for him. And could I say to you, this is grace at work. It's grace at work. That the king is searching for him. He's looking for him. And Mephibosheth has no idea that he's going to be the recipient of covenant love. He's living under condemnation. He's terrified that the king will catch up with him. He's got nothing to barter with, nothing to offer. But he's got no idea. The king is searching for him and wants to show him this covenant love. And could I say this to you tonight? It's why we should talk to people. It's why we should always talk to people about the gospel. It's why you should try to engage people with the gospel, no matter who they are. I'll tell you why. Because you have no idea what God is doing. You've got no idea what God is doing. Just don't know. And it's the reason why we should talk to people. Why we should share with people. I knew a young man. He was living on his own. He was going to get married, but he was living on his own. And this is in Belfast, and he was living on his own. And he had to get oil for his tank, for his oil system, for his heating. And the man came along to put oil in the tank for him. And as he was putting oil in the tank, the thing was filling up. And the man turned around and said to him, "Son, do you ever think about Jesus? Do you ever think about what he has done for you? That he died for you?" And then this boy was out of a Christian home. He got away. Got away from home. This man speaks to him. He couldn't answer him. And he got the oil and he paid the man. He went in and he sat down and he cried his eyes out. Wept. You see, what was happening was that the grace of God was reaching out to him. The man didn't know that. The oil man probably never knew what happened there. But he spoke a word in an opportune time, and God was able to use it. That's why we should talk to people, no matter who they are, about the gospel. God's able to do something there. And then what happens here is when the king has found him, and the king has him brought out, in verse 5, there's a journey involved. You can imagine that the king comes down into the wilderness there, to the place where he's perishing, and where he's tripled in verse 5. And it says this, and so King David had him brought from Lodabar, from the house of Machir. And there's a journey involved. There's a moving now. And look, friends, could you imagine this now? You can only imagine this. You can only imagine the thoughts that are running through his mind as he travels. What's going to happen to me here? Where am I going to end up in all this? What's going to be the end of me in it all? What's going to happen to me in it all? You can just imagine the thoughts that are flying through his mind. He's traveling to meet the king. And you can only imagine the fears that are in his heart. Look, if you're sitting here saved tonight, you can imagine what it was like before you were saved. The fears that you had. What's it all about? What if I don't come? What if I do come and I can't keep it? Do you ever feel like that? What if I make a fool of myself? What will people think of me? You can imagine he's on the journey. You know that woman I told you, the lady who came to the hotel, this man brought her to the meeting. He had just been converted. He was a lovely man. He had gone to university in England years and years ago, and he had gone to a CU meeting at university, and he had heard the gospel, and it really touched him. But just like I was saying there, the fears that he had, but what it would mean to be a real Christian. And he moved away, he got away. But then he came to Kilkenny and he started to come to the Bible study and came to church. And God began to speak to him again. And he said to me in the hotel one night, you know, what if I can't keep it? What if I make a fool of myself? And I'm saying to him, look, Danny, don't worry about that. You give it to God and he'll keep it for you. Give it to him. And that's what you've got to do. And he's this, here he is. He's the Mephibosheth is moving, if you like, from the old life to the new life. And not easy. All the fears that are coming with it. And in this lovely verse, in verse 7, there's lovely words. The king says to him, don't be afraid. See that there. Don't be afraid, David said to him. I will surely show you love and mercy, covenant love and mercy. The king was bringing him to a new life. That's what you see in the story, bringing him to a new life. You see, what was about to happen to Mephibosheth was something that he could only dream about. Couldn't even begin to imagine that. Just look for a moment at what he received under his new master. In verse 7, don't be afraid, David said to him, for I will surely show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan. I will restore to you all the land that belonged to your grandfather Saul, and you will always eat at my table. Protection. You're going to be safe here. I'm going to look after you. You're going to be safe. He would have provision when he would come. He would have a new inheritance. Never realized he had it. This inheritance that belonged to his grandfather was going to be given to him. Going to get it back. He would have a new position as well. He would eat at the king's table. I tell you, it's a most wonderful story. He would become a member of the family. Look, from being a cripple down in Macker's house and loaded the bar in the wilderness perishing, suddenly here he is and he's sitting at the king's table. You can't get the gospel clearer than that. Boy, I tell you, if you're here tonight, you're not a Christian. This is what you're missing. See, for those of us who are converted, that's where we are. Boy, lifted out of the gutter. Lifted out of the filthy life that we once lived. No matter how clean living you were, that's where you were. Capable of anything. Given the right circumstances, you could have done anything. But the grace of God lifted you. Gave you what you didn't deserve. Here you are, sitting at the king's table. Member of the family. Saved for all eternity. Boy, I'll tell you, there's nothing in all the world like this. There's not a message in all the world, not all the world like this. It's the greatest message that you'll ever hear. Travel anywhere in the world. Listen to anybody and anywhere in the world. You'll never hear anything better than this. This is God. Covenant to love you, regardless of your background, of your filthy state. See, that's how we all are, every one of us tonight. Here we are, all of us ruined by the fall, spiritually crippled, unable to walk in the paths of righteousness. Can't walk in the paths of righteousness. You can try, you can do your best. I remember when I was a teenager, had a phase where my life was in bits and I thought I would have to do something. I remember going back to church on Sunday nights in my late teens. I tell you, I desperately needed God. I remember going back to church and sitting in church and I heard nothing. Didn't hear anything that was going to do me any good. But I tell you, I went back because I was looking for something. Desperately, desperately needing help. See, I was trying to live right and I couldn't. I couldn't walk in passive righteousness because I was crippled. was crippled by the fall. I couldn't do it. I was doing my best, but the Bible tells me that all my righteous acts were like filthy rags. Not able to make it. You see, God has a covenant of blood through His Son. This covenant of blood says that He loves me and that He'll forgive me. Nothing to barter with and have nothing to trade with. But He's promised that He'll take me just as I am. He's promised that He'll take you just as you are. With all your sin and all your messed up life, He'll just take you just the way you are. But you've got to come. You've got to come. This is the invitation to it all. I want you to have a new life. He wants you to have a new beginning. I want you to have a new start. He wants to give you what you don't deserve. That's the reality here. You have to come. And never forget this. Never forget that God is looking for the Mephibosheths, this world. Are you one this evening? I'm finishing here now, but I want to say this to you. You see, with the best will in the world, you'll never look for God. You know that. You see, Mephibosheth is down in perishing in the wilderness. And there is not a hope ever that he's going to look for David. Never. He sees himself as David's enemy. He's not going to look for David. You see, and you and I will never look for God. You know, you'll never do that. Never in a million years. You'll never. Even if you're here tonight, not a Christian, you're not looking for God. If you're here, it's because God's looking for you. And I want you to keep that in mind. And never forget that. There's not any man or woman in this world ever looks for God. We hide from God. See, in the Garden of Eden, when Adam fell in the Garden of Eden, him and his wife, what did he do? He hid behind a tree. Didn't want to be found by God. You see, one of the greatest trees to hide behind in these days is religion. People hide in church sometimes. They go to church and they're hiding from God. I did a mission, and in that mission, there was a girl. She was married and a couple of children, and at the very end of the mission, she said to me, her and her husband came to me and they said, could you come and see us? And I said, okay. And they told me where she lived and where they lived, and I went to see them the next day. And I went in, and they lived in a beautiful home, and she said, I have something to say to you. And she said, I'm not a Christian. But the tragedy is, she said, everybody thinks I am a Christian. She says, I married my husband claiming to be a Christian. My in-laws, my father-in-law and mother-in-law, they all think I'm Christian. My children have been baptized in church on profession of faith. Everybody there thinks I'm a Christian, but I have never been a Christian. She just wept. And her husband was standing there and he was just weeping too. That's how they were. And for years she'd been hiding in church. But the grace of God caught up with her. Took tremendous courage for her to stand up and admit that that's where she was coming from. You know, maybe it's the same for you. Boy, I tell you, you know what, you could be here tonight and maybe everybody thinks you're a Christian. You've never, ever been born again. God has never really touched your life and you've never been changed and never been saved. And there you are still in your sin, lost, living, perishing in the wilderness, crippled by the fall. And God in His love and mercy wants to save you, wants to reach out to you, loves you and doesn't want you to be lost. You know, Mephibosheth could have said, I'm not coming. Not coming. Tell the king I'm not coming. I'm sure he's eternally glad he didn't do that. I'm sure he's eternally glad he didn't do that. And let me just tell you as I finish here now, that God offers every one of us what David offered to Mephibosheth. God offers you protection from your enemy, the devil. He offers you that. He offers you an inheritance, a position, an inheritance in heaven if you come. He offers you provision if you come. You can eat and drink with him and feed with him every day. Until that day, you eat and drink with him in heaven. This is what he's offering you. What are you going to say? You going to come? If you're not a Christian, or are you going to go on the way you are? Let me pray with you.